You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
In retrospect, I probably would have done things a little differently.
Indeed, who could have imagined that agreeing to meet with agents of a hostile government to gather information on one's father's political opponents would go badly? My guests Brian Klass and John Everard will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Venezuela's unofficial opposition referendum, a predictable result in terms of the vote and of the government's reply. So what next? South Korea offers a tentative hand over its northern border. Can it expect a response? And Tony Blair resurfaces to remind whoever might listen that Brexit might not necessarily mean Brexit.
I think it's possible now that Brexit doesn't happen. I think it's absolutely necessary that it doesn't happen because I think every day is bringing us fresh evidence that it's doing us damage.
That's all to come on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Brian Klass, Fellow in Comparative Politics at the Department of Government at the London School of Economics, and John Everard, former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea. Both would want me to tell you that they have books available for purchase. Welcome both. We will start in Venezuela, where this weekend upwards of 7 million people have voted in an unofficial opposition-organised referendum. Unsurprisingly, 98% of those who voted rejected government plans for a new constituent assembly, endorsed a call for fresh elections before 2019, and perhaps most significantly called on the armed forces to defend Venezuela's present constitution. One person was shot dead while queuing to vote. John, first of all, there's 19.5 million registered voters in Venezuela. 7 million of them turned out for this unofficial referendum, which is a better turnout than some reasonably developed democracies get. How significant is it?
Very significant. Okay, it was not part of a constitutional process. It was gesture. It was symbolic and everything. But you get 7 million people to come out, 98% of whom say essentially, you know, Maduro stinks, and we are not going to play games with the constitution the way he's trying to urge, and we think crucially that the military should support the constitution. That is a very heavy blow to an already tottering president. I mean, Maduro, remember, has had a bad few weeks. Helicopters attacking.
Bad few years, in fairness.
Yeah, the crescendo is growing louder all the time. I mean, helicopters attacking the Supreme Court. His own attorney general turning on him. The person who was shot was in a part of Caracas which traditionally has been rock solid Chavez and then Maduro supporting area. The fact that he was afraid that people even there were going to vote against him was pretty damning.
Brian, President Maduro, since the result was announced, has reaffirmed what he said beforehand, that this whole thing was, you know, a fraud and a setup, and he wouldn't pay any attention to it. Should he?
He should. I think things are spiraling out of control, as they have been for several months. This is something that will give additional ammunition to the forces against Maduro, including in the military. And there's always a risk when things are spiraling out of control as they are now of a coup, a splinter group within the military. There's also a serious risk of him being taken down by just the crescendo of protests. And so, you know, I think any time that you have these months of this growing sense of crisis, things can switch very, very quickly, especially in countries in Latin America where there is a history of this. So I think, you know, it would be unwise for him not to heed this call. And I think it's also something where we need to zoom out a little bit and think a lot of authoritarian populism we talk about is right wing. There's left wing authoritarian populism too, and they're both destructive. And it's a warning to people like Jeremy Corbyn on the left here in the UK that just because they talk about social justice, they both don't deliver. Right-wing, left-wing authoritarian populism is a damaging thing for democracy, and Maduro is no exception.
Jeremy Corbyn was, of course, quite the admirer of Hugo Chavez at the time, though he's been much quieter about that recently.
probably very wise. Not a nice end, and in the end, not a nice man. Just want to pick up a point there. Military intervention, not necessarily a coup. There's a quite a viable scenario where Maduro goes ahead with his election on 30th of July, not long to wait now, for a constituent assembly to try to change the constitution. The head of the armed forces walks to the presidential office and says, Señor Presidente, I'm sorry, I have sworn an oath to defend the constitution. I believe that what you're doing is legal. Would you please accompany me to a place of retreat somewhere outside the presidency? Well, that's not a coup, but that's entirely possible.
Well, this, Brian, was clearly the reason why the opposition rather cannily put that third question on the ballot. It's like, do you want the armed forces of Venezuela to defend the present constitution? To which, of course, every member of the armed forces of Venezuela has sworn an oath. Now, is it the case that however this shakes out, it is ultimately going to be the military that has to make a decision?
Quite possibly, and that's a very dangerous road to go down. I mean, at the point where you have the military stepping in to remove a person from power who's a civilian, you can have semantic debates about whether it's a coup or not, but it does end up creating the dynamics that lead to a cycle of military interventions. We've seen this across the world. I mean, this is something where when the military...
Akin to what used to happen fairly frequently in Turkey, where the military saw itself as the guarantor of the secular constitution.
It opens Pandora's box because at that point, the military starts to believe that it is ultimately its role to guarantee stability in the country. And then the line starts to blur of when that line has been crossed. And the military starts to think this is what we do. And it's very, very difficult in countries that have had a history of military coups to build up the decades and decades of democratic resilience to put that Pandora back in the box. And I think that that's where this is something that's going to be potentially very destructive well beyond this year. And Venezuela is not going to recover anytime soon.
Venezuela hasn't had a long history of coups. It's been a stable democracy for a very long time. And I don't think, you know, that the military would want to do anything that they would regard as illegal for all kinds of good reasons. There's another twist to this. It's not just what the military might do, it's what they might not do. Remember, a lot of the rank and file are getting seriously aggrieved. Despite the recent pay increase, 80% pay increase, they can't afford to live off their wages. If an angry mob goes to the presidency and throws Maduro out, there's every chance, in my view, that the military, instead of protecting the president, just crosses its arms, stands aside and lets things happen. In that case, likewise, it's over.
Brian, do you get the sense that we are heading for a showdown here? John mentioned, obviously, that this referendum is clearly an attempt to forestall Maduro's own referendum on July the 30th, at which he wants the power to establish a new constituent assembly, which allows him to dissolve pretty much every other institution in the country at whim. Are we reaching some sort of decision point?
I think we are, because this is unsustainable. By the way, I didn't mean to say that there is a long history of coups. I meant to say that there could be if it goes down this path, right? That we could have a cycle of coups because they do end up sparking recurring coups in other parts of the world. But I do think this is the decision point. I think it's where Venezuela cannot continue down this path of people dying, people in the streets, the government in complete disarray, and people starving, right? I mean, the medicine is unavailable. People are unable to get basic necessities in certain parts of the country. And it's reached a boiling point. So Maduro doesn't have a solution. And it's part of this, you know, sort of warning sign of don't put all of your economic eggs in one basket like Venezuela did with oil. It eventually turns out very badly. And we've seen this in other places that have military interventions, like in West Africa and Cote d'Ivoire, where there is a resilient or a complete reliance on cocoa. And eventually it just falls apart. So, you know, it's sort of a cautionary tale, both of authoritarian populism and for the necessity of economic diversification.
Well, let's move on now and take a look at North Korea, which in recent years, indeed recent decades, has not ranked among the world's foremost manufacturers of glimmers of hope. What then to make of proposals from South Korea of talks later this month? Seoul has suggested that the two Koreas parley on July 21st on North Korea's side of Panmunjom in the demilitarized zone separating the countries. South Korea is also proposing a cessation of all hostilities along the demarcation line ahead of the 64th anniversary of the effective end of the Korean War on July 27th. John, where is South Korea going with this? Because obviously in the last few weeks and months especially, what with one thing and another, the whole world has been clamouring to regard North Korea as completely unreasonable, irreconcilable, etc., etc.
Yes, where is it going with this? The answer is probably not very far. President Moon Jae-in, the recently elected president of South Korea, has a problem that in his campaign, he talked a lot about outreach, dialogue, engagement, nice you know, cuddly words, how to handle North Korea. Since he's been in office, he has found that policies is rather more constrained, both by having to at least nod towards what the Americans are worried about, and of course what they're focused on is the nuclear threat and long-range missiles, and because of North Korea's own appalling behaviour. I mean, launching missiles on the 4th of July was very, very bad manners.
Tactful.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So when he came to set out his vision for how to handle North Korea in Berlin on the 6th of July, just passed, it was a very carefully nuanced speech. Lots of stuff about we need to talk to these guys, we need to sort something out, but at the same time, quite clear recognition that you've got to stop them misbehaving, you have got to prevent the nuclear threat. And he said in that speech that he was going to start military talks. So this is just the follow-on. What's going to happen? We can't be sure, because so far there's been a kind of deafening silence out of Pyongyang. But my hunch is that they will look at what's on offer. They might be attracted by, for example, the broad hint that the South will stop the propaganda broadcasts across the DMZ, which the North really hates. Or in which case, they might try a round of talks just to pocket that concession. But the chances are that, busy as they are manufacturing nuclear weapons right now, they will just ignore him.
Brian, as we've discussed many times with John in particular on our programmes, there is no imaginable way in which any kind of confrontation with North Korea goes well for South Korea, especially in the short term. Is it possible that this is the South Korean regime reacting to America's increased bellicosity on the subject by trying to forestall any sort of showdown?
Yeah, I mean, in the American domestic political world, it is viewed as being completely untenable to have North Korea have a weapon that can reach the United States. This is something that has gotten the attention in mainstream press. It's gotten Donald Trump's attention. It worries people. You know, right now the idea is that it can hit Alaska, but at the point where there's the whiff of the possibility that Los Angeles could get taken out by President Kim, even if that may be years away before they can actually mount the warhead, et cetera, it's really galvanizing the foreign policy establishment into a new sort of hawkish type of approach, I think. And this is where, you know, I don't see how this ends well, because there's pressure on everybody to act in some way, and there is no action that doesn't end badly for virtually everyone. And this is where, you know, I mean, this is your area of expertise, but, you know, I think that this is... There's talk now in mainstream circles in the foreign policy establishment about assassination in the United States. This is being debated in mainstream news. There's talk about preemptive bombings, which obviously would destroy Seoul or would create absolute havoc in Seoul as a response, especially since North Korea has diversified where its weapons are. And I just, you know, I've really struggled with this question. What is the response? I mean, I think this is why there has been inaction in the U.S. and why it's just sort of been allowed to fester for so long, is because everybody comes back to the same answer, which is there is no good option. There are just less bad options. But I don't know if you'd agree with that, John. I mean,
yes, absolutely. Yeah. Victor Cha, the great expert, once said that North Korea really is the land of lousy options. And he was right. It's not just the options are bad. Often the options that people think are there are in fact not. Knocking out a missile on its launch pad doesn't work when the North Koreans are using mobile launchers. The first that the Americans knew of the 4th of July launch was when the missile was already launched. You don't get the chance to destroy it on its pad. Assassination attempts? Kim Jong-un's thought of that, and he is surrounded by layer after layer of security. There is obsessive secrecy over his movements. Finding out where he is extraordinarily difficult. Being able to act on that intelligence and actually move in to kill him, even more difficult. The quick, simple sort of, you know, the Gordian knot type solutions just aren't there, and I'm not sure yet that that is widely understood in the White House.
John, is it possible? And again, I've done this to you before, and I apologise again, but I'm asking you to inhabit the mind of the North Korean leadership. But is it possible that having ratcheted up tensions to the degree that they now have, they might welcome the possibility of talks as a way to climb down from the present position? Because the trajectory they are now on surely only leads at some point to some sort of confrontation, in which, while that might go badly for surrounding countries, it would definitely go badly for North Korea.
Wow. Firstly, talks quite possibly, but not with the South Koreans, who are mere puppets of the American imperialists.
Well, obviously.
Obviously. if the Americans deigned to come on bended knee, banging their head against the floor and begging Kim Jong-un to be merciful and to speak to them, he might just condescend.
That's an unlikely prospect.
Yes, indeed, this is unlikely. I am not sketching out probabilities. I'm simply trying to enter the North Korean mind as you invited me to do. The other thing is that if a conflict erupts, then yes, I think even in the deep recesses of Pyongyang, there's a recognition this will be a bad thing. But there are many outcomes short of conflict. Having credible nuclear weapons to intimidate the United States, to prevent it reinforcing its South Korean ally while you make a grab for the other half of the peninsula, that might well be part of the game plan.
OK, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Brian Klass and John Everard. Coming up next, Donald Trump, only 1,283 days to go.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first-ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's The Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are John Everard and Brian Klass. And let us look now at the United States, where it's only lunchtime on Monday in Washington, which means that we can pause to digest last week's nonsense before bracing ourselves for whatever fresh hells may confront us before close of business on Friday. President Donald Trump has today offered another defense of his eldest son, Donald Jr., who now appears to have met last summer with much of the population of Russia, with a view to smearing his father's rival for the presidency, Hillary Clinton. Trump Sr. has today tweeted, "Most politicians would have gone to a meeting like the one Don Jr. attended to get info on an opponent. That's politics." Brian, that's not actually true, is it?
It's absolutely untrue. and in fact, in 2000, when Al Gore's campaign was given George W. Bush's briefing book, they turned it into the FBI because that's what you do. And, you know, there's so many angles to this that anger me. One is that this response, which actually condones this behavior, is inviting another attack because it is saying that this is absolutely acceptable. There will be campaigns, if this becomes normal and acceptable in American politics, that will respond to a similar advance, whether by Russian intelligence or Russian nationals, for 2018. And beyond that, the other aspect of this is that Trumpism is absolutely corrupting American politics to the core. Because last summer, when Donald Jr. was accused of colluding with the Russians, he said the accusation was disgusting. And implicit in that is the idea that colluding with the Russians is a serious offense. So 2 weeks ago, we had the idea that there was no collusion. Last week, it was that collusion is not illegal. This week, it is that collusion is acceptable and normal. And, you know, the goalposts are being moved every few days.
But is that ever-shifting explanation for last summer's meeting a coherent strategy or just panic? Because they realize they've been rumbled and they're trying to find a way out of it.
So it's certainly panic. I mean, but it's a viewpoint of the world. It's a worldview where anything that we do is justifiable because we did it. And the partisans of Donald Trump are accepting this. And this is what I think is really unbelievable about what's happened in the last 18 months in American politics. If this had happened 2 years ago, if it had been, you know, somebody like Mitt Romney who had done this, the Republican Party would have devoured them. They would have destroyed them because they would have said, this is so unbelievably over the line. We're Russia hawks, right? I mean, the Republican Party for a very long time slammed Barack Obama for being weak on Putin.
Well, well within the lifetimes of many listeners, people were blacklisted for less collaboration with Russia than this.
And I mean, the security clearances would have been revoked for 1/100th of this. And now Jared Kushner, after trying to set up a secret back channel to Russia, sitting in on a meeting where he's trying to collude with Russia's government to get dirt on an American, still is sitting with a top secret security clearance advising the president of the United States. And this is something where, you know, it boggles my mind, to be honest. I mean, I couldn't have imagined this. You, even if you had an email coming in with the subject line, "We want to illegally collude with you," from Vladimir Putin, I think Fox News would defend Donald Trump in primetime, and I think a lot of his supporters would eat it up.
John, this is one of the many aspects of this story that baffles me completely, in that anybody with half a brain, and that of course may be the problem right there, would react to getting an email like that while working on a presidential campaign, much as you or I, I'm sure, would react to getting an email from the Central African Republic offering us a share in Emperor Bokassa's bullion in exchange for our bank details. I mean, it's... Is there a... I guess, obviously, that was a daft question. I was about to ask, is there an imaginably innocent explanation for this? And no, there isn't. But do we yet understand how much trouble Donald Jr. might actually be in?
No, we don't. And I've read sort of all kinds of analysis by lawyers on this, just trying to work out just how deep in he is. He is clearly in trouble. Whether the trouble turns out to be fatal, we have to see. Collusion, quite clearly, not disgusting, as Brian has pointed out, actually quite normal, and what it does it unless you are a decent human being or a Democrat. But there's no actual crime of collusion. There's a crime of conspiracy with which he might be charged if it could be shown that he was conspiring to break US electoral law. And I think it's Title 52 of the electoral law forbids receipt of any money or any other object of value from a foreign power. And I think, you know, federal courts have held that information can be regarded as an object of value. So he's on very, very thin ice. And every time he opens his mouth or his Twitter account, that ice seems to me to be getting thinner.
Brian, what do we still not know about this meeting that we actually need to know?
We need to know if Donald Trump knew about the meeting. And I think he did. But this is speculation at this point. But there is a very, very big coincidence that the Trump administration needs to explain, which is that less than 4 hours after the meeting was confirmed by Donald Trump Jr., Donald Trump announced at a rally that the following week he would be holding a major press conference with new details on all the crimes that Hillary Clinton had committed, including with regard to Russia. That is a huge coincidence. I mean, that is something that is, it defies logic. It's the first time after the meeting, by the way, on June 9th of 2016, that is the first time that Donald Trump made reference to 33,000 deleted Clinton emails. He tweeted about it that day. That's the day they met. I mean, you know, the problem with this is that the media and everybody looking at this is using the same old rules to accept this. So they say, okay, let's take them at face value when they say nothing of significance came out of this meeting. They lied about the meeting for 13 months. They lied and said there was no collusion for 13 months. Then when they were caught, they said it was about adoption. Then when they were caught and said there was emails, they said, okay, we knew it was a Russian. Then they had to release the emails because they were caught on that regard. So, you know, when they say there was nothing of significance coming from that meeting, but we know that the Russian lawyer left documents with the Trump campaign at that meeting, I don't know why anyone takes their word. I mean, they have absolutely destroyed their credibility on this issue. So I think we have to assume probably that something nefarious happened. And also, if they accepted that meeting, why wouldn't they have accepted other types of help? And this is where I think, you know, we're living in a world that is not the same world that Bob Mueller is living in. He sees all the stuff that's not public. They're not leaking stuff from the special prosecutor's investigation. And I imagine that the rabbit hole goes much, much deeper if they were as dumb as to actually literally respond to an email saying this is high-level secret information from the Russian government to help you. And his response is, I love it. When can we set it up? If they're that stupid, there's probably a lot more stuff coming out.
Well, finally tonight, we will take a look at the UK. Former Prime Minister Tony Blair spoke up on the subject of Brexit over the weekend. As usual, when Tony Blair speaks up these days, he was swiftly drowned out by the sanctimonious fury of those supporters of the party he once led, who have never quite forgiven him for winning 3 elections. Also, as usual, however, what he had to say was interesting, specifically in regard to French President Emmanuel Macron, who Blair clearly and not inaccurately regards as a spiritual heir, or as some might have it, mini-me to his Dr. Evil. John, Tony Blair said that Emmanuel Macron's accession might lead to the concessions that would lead to a softer Brexit. Is he right?
It's a nice thought. I mean, Macron's election seems to sort of move away from the wave of nationalist populism that we've seen moving across Europe. And if the election in France had gone the other way, I think Europe would have been much more difficult to deal with over Brexit. But on the other hand, I mean, whilst you can welcome from Blair's perspective what's happening in France, there's so much going wrong elsewhere in Europe. It's interesting that because on France, we don't talk so much about what's going on in Poland, where we have, you know, huge rallies at the moment trying to stop Kaczynski from effectively securing the judiciary. I suspect that any advantages to the UK in having a more internationalist, liberal-minded French president will be heavily outweighed by political shifts elsewhere within the EU.
Blair was fairly unabashed and unapologetic about his own views on Brexit. He said it was in the national interest that it be stopped, which is certainly a more strident tone on it than any current politician has taken. The concessions he's talking about that might lead to it being stopped are inevitably going to, I think, refer to freedom of movement within Europe, because I think when all else is stripped away, last summer's referendum was a referendum on immigration. Is it time for more governments to start admitting that perhaps freedom of movement was oversold as an idea?
I don't think the idea was oversold. I think the implementation could be done slightly differently. And what I mean by that is, I mean, as an American, it is strange when you drive between European countries and there's not even a single person there, especially given the number of people that have entered Europe with very flimsy checks. I could see a world in which there were border checks that were automated in the coming years, where they simply have to slide a passport across a, you know, barcode and make sure that you're legally there. And I think that would solve some of the security dilemmas without actually solving free movement. I don't know if Macron fundamentally changes the calculation, though, because as an internationalist who believes in the European project, this is the core of the European project. I mean, this is something that is absolutely fundamental to it. And it's where I think a lot of the politicians who are invested in Europe as an idea, they're willing to have some short-term economic pain to create the idea that lasts. And I think that this, if you sacrifice free movement, one of the core ideas of Europe, it starts making everything else negotiable. And that probably is the beginning of the end of the European Union as we know it, I would think.
John, is there an argument for some sort of, I guess, restriction, break, call it what you will, on freedom of movement, if for no other reason than that it would cut off at the knees every anti-immigration populist movement in Europe?
Well, yes, it would have that effect. But as Brian's pointed out, it would also cut off at the knees large parts of the European ideal. It's a tremendous price to pay. There is already legislation available the governments can invoke if they have temporarily to halt immigration for a national crisis of whatever kind. So, you know, there are breaks there. But to actually reintroduce checks on freedom of movement within Europe, I think a lot of people right at the top of the European Union would fight into the last ditch to prevent.
But a lot of people, and this is a graceless way to talk about voters, but you know where I'm going with this, at the bottom of the European project don't like them. They don't like open borders. They never asked for them, and they don't like them.
No, that's right. It's part of the huge disconnect between the European leadership and the and a lot of people within Europe. It's not just over immigration, is it? Where you'd go with that in the end, heaven only knows. I mean, the logic of your position, I think, was that if, you know, people out there really don't like freedom of movement, then this is supposed to be a democracy. We ought not to have it. And there goes large parts of the EU. Do you then blow up the whole thing and start again?
Is it? Final thought, I guess, on this, Brian. Is it absolutely indivisible from the EU project, freedom of movement? I mean, obviously, you come from a place like the United States, and you can drive between any of the contiguous US states without border checks. But is it naive to think that Europe is essentially the same construct or the same sort of construct?
Well, I think because Europe was founded on this idea, it is core to the project. And I think also it'd be very unworkable if you had border checks that involve visa quotas, because it would be so uneven where the people would be going, right? I mean, there's obviously a much stronger pull towards Western Europe, so it would be hard to get everyone to agree to the new system. But it's also, I think, more fundamentally, this is a system about trade-offs. People make trade-off decisions when they decide to join the European Union. Yes, you get massive economic benefits, and that comes with the fact that you accept responsibilities. And I think that at some point, you have to say, look, if you want the economic benefits, you take the responsibilities. countries. And those are very real. At the point where you get to pick and choose, the European project is one that I think will start to disintegrate, because everybody will pick and choose according to their own national interest, and then all of a sudden there's no cooperation, the borders go back up, and we're back to square one.
And there's another point here, that we have freedom of capital. Having freedom of capital without free movement of labor is bad economics.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. John Everard, Brian Klass, thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hester Underhill. Our studio managers were Kieran Banerjee and Christy Evans. More music next at 1900. It's Culture with Robert Bound, and there's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.